Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Genesis 44, verse 1. Then he commanded the steward of his house, fill each man's sack with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain. And they did as Joseph commanded them. All right, as soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and that from this he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this. When he overtook them, he spoke these words. They said to him, what does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such things. Behold, the money that we found in the mouths of our sacks we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How could we then steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. He said, let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent. Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack, and he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey when they returned, and they returned to the city. Okay, so Joseph is playing a trick on them, I suppose. This is kind of a messed up trick because he's convinced them that basically Benjamin is going to die. He's hidden his chalice, his royal chalice or whatever, in Benjamin's grain sack. In addition to the money, he's doing that same trick again. He's giving them their money back. Now, I can't imagine what kind of grief these poor brothers are going through. But on the other hand, they do kind of have it coming. And this is no worse than anything he did to them. So he's making them, they tear their clothes, they're so grieved at what they think is going to happen. And there's a kind of irony to it. They're upset, keep this in mind, they're upset because their youngest brother might die. Now, meanwhile, they had tried to kill Joseph at first already, and they sold him into slavery. So now the tables have turned. Well, I don't know if the tables have turned, but it's ironic that this thing that they were so casual about, yeah, why don't we just kill Joseph? No, let's not kill him. Let's put him into a pit. No, let's not put him into a pit. Let's sell him into slavery. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's all get together and do that. This thing that they were so casual about before, now all of a sudden they're upset because something might happen to one of their brothers. Gee, maybe they should have been a better keeper of their brothers before. So, as much as it is a kind of mean trick, I struggle to have empathy for these brothers, especially with the parallel between Joseph and Benjamin. All right, so verse 14. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said, what deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination? And Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and those also, and he also in whose hand the cup has been found. But he said, far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go in peace to your father. So again, at this point, they're so terrified because if Benjamin doesn't come back, then their father is going to die of grief, basically, is what they're expecting to happen. And Joseph is playing on their worst fears because it's one thing for them all to be enslaved together. But it's another thing for the exact thing they fear, for them to all return in shame because they didn't protect their brother and their youngest brother is as good as dead. Again, the parallel to Joseph, they're terrified of this thing that may happen, whereas when it happened with Joseph, they were really happy about it. So again, my empathy for these guys is not not particularly strong. And let's see. It's interesting. At first, it talks about that that he'll be put to death, but then it turns into a servant. You'll be a slave, basically. You'll be a servant. All right, verse 18. Then Judah went up to him and said, "O my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's ear, and let now your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servants, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a younger brother, the child of his own age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, so that his father loves him.'" Again, Benjamin and Joseph are the two children of Rachel. That's the reason they're loved more than anybody else. "Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' We said to my lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' Then you said to your servant, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again.'" So Judah is going back over the grievous process of how difficult it was even to bring Benjamin in the first place, let alone now Benjamin isn't going to come back. So Genesis 44, verse 24. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord, and what our father said, 'Go again and buy a little food.' We said, 'We cannot go down if our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face until our youngest brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one from me also, and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs in evil to Sheol. Now, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servant will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." So Judah is throwing himself on the mercy of Joseph. He's saying that if Benjamin doesn't return, then their father will die. And that specifically, and this is something that you read about in previous chapters, that specifically Judah promised, Judah says, Benjamin will come back. I give my life as a pledge that if Benjamin doesn't return, I will not return. In fact, anything, any harm that's going to befall Benjamin, let it fall on me instead. So again, Judah is acting nobly for the sake of his brother, if only he had done this for Joseph in the first place. All right, so how long can Joseph keep up this trick against his grieving brothers? Chapter 45. Then Joseph could not control himself before all who stood before him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him. And then Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So they are completely dumbfounded. This guy that they thought that they had killed or sold into slavery or died on his own is standing before them and now is the one who can save Benjamin. They don't understand this whole thing about maybe Benjamin stole the cup. It's interesting. It's never argued that Benjamin did not steal the cup. Somebody put it in our sack. They don't even bother arguing that. They just say, whatever happened, take me instead of Benjamin. Verse 4. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God has sent me here before you to preserve your life. For the famine has been in the land 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you, a remnant on the earth, and keep you alive for you many survivors. For it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and a lord over all his house, and a ruler over the land of Egypt. hurry and go to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord over all Egypt. Come down, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the house of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. Therefore, I'll provide for you. And there are yet 5 years of famine yet to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all of his brothers and wept upon them, and that his brothers talked with him. After that, his brothers talked with him. So he can't keep up the charade forever, and he is just so grieved at the possibility of his father dying, and so happy that he can provide for these people. But it's interesting how Joseph contextualizes his time in Egypt. Now, he does say that they sold him into slavery. And he says, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. So he acknowledges, one, that they did something that was wrong. They sold him into slavery. Obviously, that's wrong. But then, two, and this is a phrase he'll use later, that God actually used this evil act of theirs for good. And in cases like this, I think it's good to take a page from Joseph, not to, you know, pull tricks on your brothers and stuff like that and upset them, but to look at every time something happens to you in your life where it's either somebody acts in evil against you, or it's calamity, or it's a mistake, or it's whatever, a health condition, whatever negative thing happens to you, rather than dwelling on the negative, and contrast what his brothers did. When his brothers thought that they were in trouble, they were saying, oh, this is my fault. I brought this on myself. This is God punishing me for my crime. And Joseph is taking that away from them by forgiving them. So instead of that, Joseph doesn't say, well, I'm in Egypt because God's punishing me for being a jerk to my brothers and tattling on them and telling them the dreams about them bowing down to me and acting like I'm better than them. That's not what he says, but instead he just bears the suffering. Then after the suffering, he can look back and say, oh, looking back, this is why I see God let this happen. Now, while he's going through the suffering, when he's in Potiphar's house, when he's a slave in Potiphar's house, when he's falsely accused, when he goes into prison, when he's forgotten in prison for years, he doesn't know why God is letting this happen. You don't have passages there where he says, God is doing this so that I can feed my brothers and my family in Egypt. So keep that in mind when you're going through the suffering of your own life, that in the moment you may not have that revelation. In fact, you probably won't, where you're saying, why is God allowing this horrible suffering to take place? After the fact, Joseph was given, you know, it was made clear to him. It's like, oh, that's why God was using that to put me in this place, to humble me, to raise me up, and then to put me in charge of all of the food in Egypt so that I could take care of the people. And then this will go on, and he doesn't realize this yet, but he kind of hints at it, that this is the promise for you and for your children, and for your children's children, your flocks and your herds, et cetera, et cetera, stuff. This promise is made to his father, and this is a Hebrewism. This is a phrase that is used regularly. This promise is for you and for your children, for those who are near, for those who are far off. Can anybody remember any phrase in the New Testament that sounds similar to that? Maybe you don't know it off the top of your head. I just use it because I argue a lot. Peter's sermon at Acts 2:38. He says, "You know, why do I have to? I always pretend like I have to have it memorized, and I don't. Let me read Peter's words." So this is a common, this is a way that God gives promises to people. All right, Acts 2:38. I'll do 2:37. Now when they had heard this, they were cut, 2:36. Peter's giving his sermon, and he ends with this: let the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. Now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brothers, what shall we do? And Peter said to them, repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ, for the forgiveness of your sins, and you will receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. Verse 39, for the promise is for you and for your children and for all who are far off, everyone in whom the Lord calls to himself. So this promise, this idea is manifold. So one, this promise is for you. Two, this promise is for your children. And yes, it does actually mean children. And then it talks about your children's children as well. So it's not just descendants, but it's talking about an individual, the individual's household, even yes, children, even yes, for baptism. And then it talks about also those who are extended beyond the household as well. So this is something that'll come up a couple of times with promises in the Old Testament as well. It's a Hebrewism. It's a pattern that God blesses people. It says you and your household go and do whatever. You and your household will be blessed. All right. So in this case, Joseph is giving God's promise to the people. He doesn't know at this moment the whole story of Exodus and how numerous the Israelites will get. So again, at this point, you've just got the brothers. You got Joseph and his brothers and his father, and they're going to go into Egypt. If you remember, if you fast forward mentally a bit, there's going to be a lot of Israelites in Egypt, and that's kind of going to be a big theme when they get enslaved and they have to come out of Egypt. But at this point, they're going to be brought into Egypt to be preserved from the famine. All right, let me see if there's anything else in this section. It was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord over all of his house. So again, even with his suffering, even with the horrible things that happen, Joseph credits God for making something out of it. Because if it's just up to us and we're just in this world and God isn't involved, then anytime something bad happens, we have to throw up our hands and say, oh man, I rolled the dice, I got unlucky, the universe is chaos, nothing happens for a reason, it's just, I'm suffering for no reason, it's hopeless, I'm helpless, there's no point to any of it. Meanwhile, Joseph understands that even his suffering, God permitted his suffering to come to him. Paul later talks about a thorn in the flesh and that God allows sometimes suffering. In Paul's case, it was to keep him humble. In this case, God allowed the suffering of Joseph to then use it to provide for others. Now, what's difficult is I am not a prophet. I am not God. I am not omniscient. So when somebody comes up and they say, Pastor, why am I suffering? Why do I have this disease? Why do I have this thing in my life? Why has this happened to a family member, something like that? I don't have God's knowledge, and I can't say, oh, this is the reason, because you're going to save people from a famine in Egypt or whatever. I don't know that. I don't know why God is permitting suffering, but I do know that God uses even evil people and even evil things that happen for good. He uses bad things that happen for good. And we can, as Christians, hate the evil, say, you sold me into slavery, that was wrong, but at the same time rejoice and say, but God used that evil for good. We can rejoice in the good that God does, and we can also despise the wickedness that God often uses as a catalyst. All right, when the report was heard, Genesis 45, verse 16. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come, it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go to the land of Canaan and take your father and your household and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones, for your wives. Bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. The sons of Israel did so. Remember, this is Jacob's name is Israel. The sons of Israel did so. Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and to all of them he gave a change of clothes. But to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. Again, these clothes keep coming up in Joseph's story. To his father he sent as follows. 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provisions for his father on the journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the way. So they went up to Egypt and came to... he just knows them so well. He says, don't be you. So they went up to Egypt, and they came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob, and they told him, Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. and his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he said to them, and when he saw the wagons Joseph sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." So this is wonderful. Now, keep in mind, as they're moving, that Canaan was this is the promised land. This is where God will bring them back to eventually. Egypt, even though is where they're going to be taken care of, Egypt is not the promised land. When they go to Egypt, that is not the land that they will, that's a land where they will sojourn for a time. This is not, oh, we're in Egypt, this is our eternity in paradise. That picture is more for their promised land. Egypt is a temporary time where they'll be taken care of, but then they'll also suffer things. You can draw parallels if you'd like. Chapter 46. So Israel took his journey. Let me check the time. Good. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." Interesting, he just goes back and forth with his name. And he said, "Here am I." Then he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you into Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. And Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." A couple of little Hebrewisms here to pay attention to, and you'll see this with a couple of different cities. Jerusalem, Israel, the location Israel, not the person, or Jerusalem, Jerusalem in particular, the holy city, this is the city of promise. In the Bible, you don't go down to Jerusalem. Don't just think about it in terms of north and south on a map. Yes, Egypt is south of Jerusalem. Yes, Egypt is south of Israel. But there are certain lesser places, according to the Bible. Jerusalem, Babylon, Jericho. In the Bible, it doesn't say, and then he went up to Jericho. You don't go up to Jericho, you go down to Jericho. You don't go up to Egypt. Oh, that's a nice place. No, you go down to Egypt, down to Sheol, down to the pit, up to Jerusalem. So this is a language that anytime you hear it, you could just think about it like ringing a bell. Oh, okay, yeah. This is going up to Jerusalem. This is the place of promise. So even though he will go down to Egypt, he will come up to Jerusalem. He will be exalted again, even though he goes down to the lesser place. It also wouldn't hurt to keep in mind, as you're going through this entire story, the parallel between this Joseph and another Joseph in the New Testament who goes down to Egypt and is promised to go down to Egypt, and God communicates this to him in a dream with angels and such. But goes down to Egypt for a period of time to be taken care of, and then is brought back up out of Egypt to the place where he's going to do his real work. So Egypt is a temporary, it's purgatory. It's a temporary location that they have to stay for a little while, whether it's Joseph or it's Joseph. Verse 5, chapter 46, verse 5. Then Jacob sent out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones and their wives and the wagons that Pharaoh had set to carry them. Okay, again, and I don't mean this as an I told you so, but it is an I told you so. It includes the little ones. So this phrase that is used in Acts 2:38 and 2:39 to talk about the promises of baptism, that in for you and for your children, it does literally mean infants and children, the little ones as well. So never let anybody say, well, this promise of baptism is not for adults, and this passage in Acts 2:38 doesn't refer to kids. It just refers to offspring who are already grown. No, the Hebrewism means that it's the household full of the young ones as well. But there are young ones here. Yes, sir. Do you have a question? I was trying to read your mind. Is he wondering where the little ones came from if Jacob is so old? Yeah.
He needs some advice, I guess.
Yeah, we can bring them to quote Flame, bring those babies to the font. It's difficult outside of, baptism for infants has been a pretty regular thing, even early on in church history. But the difficulty is later on when baptism turns into a work that the person does, where it says, I have decided to be baptized. I am choosing to be baptized. I am choosing to be a believer. I am choosing Jesus. Then they say, well, okay, if you're choosing, then you have to be smart enough to choose first. If it's on you, then you have to be an adult to make that choice, to make that work, which is how this idea that children can't choose, therefore children can't be baptized, comes in. But if we're saying that this is a blessing, a gift from God, like God bringing the people into Egypt, this isn't something that the children are choosing. This is something where the kids are getting dragged along. Or if we're comparing it to crossing over the Red Sea, which if we keep going through Exodus, we'll get to, it's not that the children make a choice for themselves. The infants walk through the Red Sea on their own feet, but rather that you sometimes get dragged along with your family for better or for worse. When you're an infant and your family drags you to the doctor, that's usually for your own good. When you're an infant and your family drags you to church, or when you're a teenager and your family drags you to church, not saying that you're being dragged, but as a teenager, I was dragged to church. I would much rather have slept in, and thanks be to God that my family dragged me to church. It's better to be in church and not want to be in church than not to be in church at all. In any case, big tangent. All right. Let me see. Let's do verse 6. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they had gained in the land of Canaan, and they came to Egypt, Jacob and all of his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons, with him and his daughters, with his sons' daughters. And all his offspring he brought with him into Egypt. Now these are the names of the descendants of Israel. Okay, so we got one of these lists again. Now these are the names of the descendants of Israel who came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, the sons of Reuben, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Yachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judith, Onan. We heard about those guys. Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. You remember a few chapters ago. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Issachar, Tola, Puva, Yob, and Shimron. The sons of Zebulon, Sered, Elon, and Jahiel. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padan Aram, together with his daughter Dinah, according to his sons, and the daughters numbered 33. The sons of Gad, Ziphion, Haggi, Shuni, Esbon, Eri, Arodi, and Areli. The sons of Asher, Imnah, Ishva, Ishvi, Beriah, with Sarah their sister, the sons of Beriah, Heber, and Malchiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bore to Jacob, 16 persons. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, Joseph, and Benjamin. And so Joseph, in the land of Egypt, and to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him. And the sons of Benjamin, Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Mupim and Hupim. I hope they're twins. And Ard, these are the sons of Rachel who bore to Jacob, 14 persons in all. The sons of Dan, Hushim, the sons of Naphtali, Jaziel, Guni, Jerez, and Shillem, Jezer and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to Rachel his daughter, and she bore to Jacob, 7 persons in all. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt, who were his own descendants, not including Jacob's sons, wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who bore him in Egypt were 2. And the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. There might be some stuff with numbers here. You can play with numbers here if you want to. I'm hesitant to play with numbers unless the Bible connects numbers like 12 tribes, 12 disciples, stuff like that. There's some times where it's 40 days in the wilderness, 40 years in the wilderness, 40 days and 40 nights with Noah, stuff like that. 3 is often the number of God. A lot of times things are duplicated. 70, maybe that's a number that means perfection because that's kind of what 7 often means. Make of it what you will. The Bible doesn't specifically say these things. Something that is important, though, is that this family tree is given in detail. And now, again, if you're operating under the assumption, the higher critical assumption, that this is just ancient Near East poetry, and this is just people making stuff up as they go, these lists, which we've unfortunately stubbed our toe on every few chapters, are here to remind you that, no, these are actual people. This is an actual family tree. Some of these people in the family tree died. Some of these people bore more children than other people. They're all related to each other. This is how they're related to each other. This is how old they are, that kind of thing. So this is a reminder that this is a real history that's being accounted here. And again, it's a very Hebrew way of doing things, a helical way of coming back to the same point in different ways, that multiple times we've been told who people's children are, who people's descendants are, how many children people have. It's repeated a few times. Yes, sir?
Can we connect these 70 to the 70 of the mission that Jesus sent out?
Didn't he send out 72? Or am I thinking that wrong? 70. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. There's I know a pastor who's done a bunch of studies on these, on the numbers and stuff like that. I could probably bug him. I took a picture of it. I wish I kept. I don't know where it is. I've got a picture of it. He wrote on a chalkboard. He says this is generally what the numbers reference consistently in the Bible, and this is based on some book somebody else has written. And I didn't remember it all. All right, so we're in chapter 46, verse 28. We just went through all the people who went into Egypt. He sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck for a good while. Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive." Keep that phrase in mind. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls on you and says, "What is your occupation?" you shall say, "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians." Interesting. We'll get into that in a minute. This phrase here, does this phrase sound like anything you've ever heard, let's say, in the New Testament? Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive. Yeah, is that in our, do we have the Nifty Minutes today? What are we, two? Three, we do have the Nifty Minutes. "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy will, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people." And this is Simeon's song in the New Testament when he holds the Christ. He says, "Now I can die, because I was promised that I'd be able to see the Christ before I die. And now that's fulfilled, and I can rest in peace." Requiesce in pace, as some might say. All right, chapter 47. We've got time. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, "My father and his brothers with their flocks and their herds and all I possess have come from the land of Canaan. They are now in the land of Goshen. From among his brothers he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, 'What is your occupation?' They said to Pharaoh, 'Your servants are shepherds, as our fathers are.' So they said to Pharaoh, 'We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan, and now please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen.' Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them settle in the land of Goshen. You may, and if you know any men among them, put them in charge of my livestock.'" So it's interesting that the Pharaoh not only allows this abomination, this practice of disgusting shepherds, but he also says, "Let your shepherds work for me as well. Take care of mine as well." Then Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many are the days and the years of your life?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. And they have not attained to the days and the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Then Joseph settled with his fathers and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt and the best in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father with his brothers and his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. Look something up real quick. 40, verse 11. Okay, so this section here, it refers to the land of Ramesses. I think this is one of the places that people get the idea that the Pharaoh during the time of the Exodus is Ramesses II, but really Ramesses is the name of the city. But whatever, I'm not gonna get into that because I don't know it backwards and forwards like maybe I should. All right, verse 13. Now there was no food in the land, for the famine was very severe. So the land of Egypt and land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone." And Joseph answered, "Give your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys. He supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent. The herds of our livestock are my lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we with our land will be servants to Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe on them. The land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from the Pharaoh, and they lived on the allowance that Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. So this is the expansion of Egypt. Egypt wasn't always this powerhouse. You'll see how Joseph, with the wisdom given from him from God, parlays into, I mean, it's an investment scheme. I don't want to say a scheme because it's fine what he did, but it's also brilliant. He knows that there's going to be a famine. So he stocks up on all this food. And then everybody comes to the land and they give him all their money. And so now he's rich and he's got food. Then people say, "We're still starving." And he comes to them and they give them all of their livestock. Now he's rich and he has all the livestock and he has all the food. They come back and they say, "We've got nothing else. We'll give you the land itself. So buy this without conquest." So this is one of the ways that you could expand your borders, is just go kill everybody whose land you want and take it from them. Instead of conquest, through commerce, Joseph expands the land of Egypt to make it extremely wealthy and extremely large. So Pharaoh, however important Pharaoh happened to be at that time, is now way more important. Now you have tons of servants, not just the Israelites, who will become slaves later on, but you have tons of servants all throughout the land, tons of slaves throughout the land of Egypt, and all their land belongs to Pharaoh. And nobody had to fight a war for any of it. All right, verse 23. Then Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now that here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And all the harvests you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the fields, and as food for yourselves and your household, and food for your little ones." And they said, "You have saved our lives. May it please my lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh." So Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day that Pharaoh should have the fifth of the land, the land of the priests alone did not become Pharaoh's. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph to him and said, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt." Keep that in mind for chapters and chapters later in Exodus. "Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he answered, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear it to me. And he swore it to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. All right. We don't have time to get into the last three chapters, but you're starting to see, so we're ending at the end of chapter 47. You're starting to see the setup. If you know what comes next in the story with the Exodus and the Israelites leaving Egypt, you're seeing that set up here. So a lot of times when we're doing kind of the Bible stories, we do them out of order, that's fine. But if you're a little kid and you're going through the Bible story, you say, wait, you know, how come Pharaoh's so rich? How come he's so powerful? Was he a conqueror? Was he like Alexander the Great? Did he spread out his armies and conquer all of these nations? Was it like Babylon or something like that? Why were the Israelites there? Why were they slaves in Egypt in the first place? Now you have the backstory setting all of this up, and what God uses it for. What God uses it for later. You also start to see some parallels also with other places in the Bible, other things that happen as well. So with that, let's close with the doxology.